Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome back to the Lantern Rouge Cycling Podcast. A little bit of a different interview today. We have Matthew Hagebaur coming on the podcast, the head of performance at Jumbo Visma, to answer some questions like, what does a head of performance actually mean? Because I've been working with Matthew for about a year and a half now on some climbing stuff and other things for Jumbo, more race analysis, but I don't know what head of performance means. And it actually means different things across different World Tour teams. And so we'll talk about that, as well as polarized versus pyramidal training, the Norwegian method, lactate measurement, some of the actual training stuff that's relevant to amateur cyclists as well as what's changed a lot, or what are the big things that have changed in World Tour training across the season in the last 10 years or 5 years as well, and how that differs between riders. So I thought it'd be good to fill the space this week before the Tour de France preview. We were going to record that Monday or Tuesday. We'll let you know on Twitter, on the LRCP Twitter account, when we've recorded it and when to expect it. But I hope you enjoyed this interview with more of a training and performance focus from the inside of the World Tour. Welcome to the Lantern Rouge Cycling Podcast, Mathieu. Thanks for taking the time out before the Tour de France. Probably a pretty busy time for you, an important time, especially with the National Championships time trial yesterday for multiple riders on Jumbo. But we're going to do sort of a broad overview of what a performance manager or a head of performance does, you know, in a World Tour team. And I wanted to know what's your background. I know you were a rider, but in terms of you're a rider for how long, and then what did you study? And yeah, just your background in the sport, because you've been in the sport for a long time.
Yeah, so I was a professional rider for 3 years with Cofidis between 2006-2008. Before that, I was 2 years on the Rabobank under 23 squad, which was already quite a professional environment. During my professional career, I was also still studying human movement sciences in Maastricht University, which is basically being educated in exercise physiology and nutrition, and educated as a scientist. And I finished my studies in 2007. So when I was professional, but I wasn't really a good professional. So I already quit cycling in 2008. And then I got offered a job at the Rabobank development team again, to okay. become a trainer there by Louis de la Haye, who was then, let's say, performance manager at Rabobank. And he asked me to train some riders there. So I started coaching 5 or 6 riders just as a part-time job. But pretty quickly, I grew more into the organization and got more responsibilities and got responsibility as let's say, performance manager or head coach at the under 23 team of Rabobank until 2012. And then Rabobank pulled the plug from the sponsorship. And I went with a professional team, then Blanco, and then Lotto Jumbo, and then Jumbo Visma. And then from 2016, I was really head of performance. So from that time, I'm in the role that I'm now in as well.
Okay, and what does a head of performance do? Because I was looking around all the team websites, Ineos, EF, UAE, Jumbo, and it's not really a defined structure that applies to all the teams, and there's sort of a different structure across a lot of the teams. UAE is probably a little bit similar. But so what does a head of performance, or what do you actually do as a head of performance? What are your main roles and responsibilities?
So my main responsibility is making sure riders are optimally prepared for the race. So I'm less involved in making the selections for a race or a strategics, etc. Also, I talk a lot with Marijn and Grisha about that as well. But my main responsibility is making sure riders get into a race with the best condition, with the best nutrition, with the best equipment. So we have three pillars behind performance, which are training, which is nutrition, and which is equipment. And those are my key responsibilities, making sure that's all in order. And obviously we have a big group of people I'm working with. So we have four in the World Tour team, we have four trainers coaching all the riders individually. We have a fantastic nutrition team led by Martijn Redegeld. And we have also people working on the equipment, and especially the performance side of equipment is led by Jenko Drost. And we just acquainted Martens, a former rider of our team, as head of apparel, which means he is becoming responsible for all the non-bike parts. So that means clothing, helmets, etc. So they are all part of the performance team, which is led by me. But that's hopefully it's clear that those are my responsibilities.
So you, just narrowing down on the equipment side of things, so like you don't have an engineering degree. So is that, his name was Drost, is he more like the engineer who will assess on an engineering basis potential equipment changes, and then you will also sort of assess those results above him? I presume the same thing happens at Ineos with Bigham doing that role as an engineer, and then someone above him says, okay, that sounds right, we're going to use that piece of equipment.
Yeah, exactly. So in my role, it's also important to follow the big lines, and that we have a clear vision where we are going to. I'm not a super technical guy, so that's why Jenko is in our team, to make sure that on the technical side of the equipment, everything is right. And we're not doing like stupid stuff that's very innovative, but maybe also very risky. He is the guy to make those assessments. But in general, when we are going to a race like the Tour de France, I make an analysis of the course. I make sure that we are knowing what is needed on that course, on a TT course, for example. And then I talk with Jenko together how we're going to approach that equipment setup for that specific race. And he is going much more into details about wheel choice, tire choice, etc., etc. So that's a little bit how it goes.
Okay. And regarding coaching and training riders, do you still coach riders yourself, or are you kind of like, I think Dan Lorang at Bora, he stepped away from that and now he manages a team of coaches under him at Bora Hansgrohe without actually coaching any rider himself?
No, I do still coach riders myself. Yeah. So I'm working on an individual basis with some riders in the team. But okay. We have divided this group in, let's say, four groups of riders. And we have Marijn Zeeman, Tim Heemskerk, and Mark Lamberts as the other three coaches who are coaching the riders individually on training. But training is only one part of the equation. Then we have Martijn Redegeld, who is there working on the nutrition programs and other experts. Especially, we have also added a strength and conditioning coach to our performance team to minimize risk on injury, and also to make sure rehabilitation times become shorter, because we analyzed the last few years that we are losing a lot of racing days because of riders being injured or being sick. And we felt we had to make a step forward on that. So that's why we also added Jarno in this case to our team. But he is more working on the off-the-bike exercises, off-the-bike training, let's say, whereas Mark, Marijn, Tim, and me are mostly working on-the-bike training.
Okay. And as head of performance, is there like an overall training philosophy that you subscribe to that then gets pushed and is evident in sort of the training plans those those coaches do. Like what I'm talking about is, you know, the methodologies or systems like polarized training versus pyramidal training, or like the new hot one is Norwegian method, whatever that means, with 1,000 lactate measurements and double training days, or is there no real, there's no real Jumbo Visma philosophy of training?
Well, definitely there is, because it's important in our philosophy. It shouldn't really matter who is your coach, especially on the physical side of things, let's say. So it's not possible that Tim Heemskerk is taking a completely other approach than me, working with riders, both working to the Tour de France, for example. So we are discussing a lot together. We have a lot of meetings together. So I also don't really like the idea that saying like I'm the coach of Jos van Emden, for example, because we are doing it together. I get a lot of input from my colleagues and also from the nutrition side, etc., to make the ideal program. And that means that riders of Team Jumbo-Visma, they are coached by a group of people and not by a specific coach. And in that case, so that's why it's important to follow more or less the same philosophy. And that's the philosophy. It's not like a fixed philosophy, because we are discussing and we are evaluating and we are trying to improving our methods. But like I say, it's not possible that one of our coaches suddenly does a complete other training session that we haven't discussed before. And that's my responsibility, to make sure we are following the bigger lines and we are following the same philosophy. Obviously, when coaching riders, there's also the fact of chemistry between people, and that's why we try to pick a little bit me with some riders and Marijn with some riders, because we think the chemistry between those people, this coach and this rider, is very good, and that keeps, like, let's say, still in a motivational environment every year. So that's still a part of, but it's also important. But in terms of training methods, it's we're following more or less the same philosophy together.
And how much has that changed, or what's been the biggest changes in, say, from 2012, the last 10 years, and then the last 5 years, and the last 2 years? As because there's been a lot of changes. I mean, power meters were already around and being used in 2012. People were training to power then. But what do you think have been the biggest changes in? I think nutrition has changed a lot in the last with carbohydrates in the last 5-7 years. But specifically with training, what do you think have been the biggest changes in the sort of long term, medium term, and short term at World Tour level?
So I think the number of intensity days, the number of intensive trainings, especially in winter time, has increased a lot. That's the biggest change from 2012 until now. And also the rest period after a season has shortened, especially when we look at our practice, let's say. When I was a rider still myself, I took maybe 6 weeks off the bike and then restarted training. But nowadays, we try to limit those off the bike periods in order not to lose too much and to make sure you start at a decent level already in November. And that doesn't mean in November you start training immediately with 20 or 25 hours, but say the period of inactivity, complete inactivity, has shortened a lot. In big lines, those are the things that has changed most compared to 10 years ago. And obviously then more on a detailed basis, detailed thing, you can say type of training has changed a little bit. Number of training days on one day, so double days, has increased a little bit since 2016 or 2017. Those things have changed a little bit, but I think the biggest change is more intensive training already in the winter and less inactivity in the winter.
Okay, so the days of the 30 hours for 2 months, December, January, no sprints, they're done. That's everywhere, I think, because I think that's evident when you see the January and February races and you compare. When I compare the January and February races and the watts per kilo and the performances to 5-7 years ago, all these races are much more fiercely contested. A larger pool of riders are already in pretty good shape already February 1st.
Yeah, it's true. So the level we are seeing already in December training camps is pretty high, and that's really a big difference from a few years ago. I remember that a few years ago when we were in December camp, there were always a few riders who were really off the pace. They even couldn't follow, let's say, a 220 watt uphill ride, and they really needed a few weeks to come back at a decent level. But those times are really gone. Everybody already in December is well prepared. I think thinking of it now, also what has changed is the type of sport. So the type of activity that's been done by professional cyclists has expanded. So we have I can say almost all riders are running in the winter.
Really?
Yeah.
And you just let them do it, or you have some pretty, because like injury risk with running is high. Is there some pretty strict guidelines on if you're going to run, don't fuck yourself up and give yourself a metatarsal injury?
Yeah, obviously. And also if you don't have experience in running, don't do it. Or if you want to start, then we are pretty strict on let's say a build-up program when running, which starts with just walking and jogging. And not on a hard surface, but rather on a soft surface, to make sure that there's really a gradual increase in load. But I must say, already this generation has been raised with other sports, and it's also something we are really encouraging in our under 23 squad to do other sports than only cycling, because I also think that's science already showed that the top elite athletes performing nowadays, they have a really broad background of sports and not just only cycling. And I also think in terms of injury risk, it's obviously when you're not used to run, then it's a risk. But if you're already been used to run, it's in fact injury reducing. To be able to do other sports only than cycling.
Especially with cyclists, like some of them, if they've only been cycling, they never do any load bearing activity, one crash, bang, broken bone. And I'm not sure, like, you, even if you run in November, if you crash, you can obviously still break your bones, but it must help doing some load bearing activity. At least, and I guess Schemo as well is popular, and you know Mike Woods on Israel. I think he does a lot of ski mountaineering. He obviously did a lot of running, and you know he was podiuming in monuments at 34 after coming into the sport late. Okay, what? This is more of an amateur cycling interest question. Traditionally, or not traditionally, but like the easiest way for a new cyclist gets a new power meter, they get a power meter, like, oh my God, I don't have to train to heart rate anymore. I can train to zones. They go out and they do an FTP test, whether it's a 20-minute test, and then they take 95% of that power and say that's my FTP, and then set zones off that with the warm-up protocol, whether it's a ramp test. Is that dead at World Tour level? Like, how are zones being set? Now, is it by an FTP or ramp test, or is it through lactate? Because all the Norwegian stuff is just like lactate measurement. Are zones now being set by power at specific lactate thresholds for the whole training plan?
Yeah, obviously, I'm not talking about complete will to level, because I still think 20 minute tests are done and used as a setting an FTP and setting zones. The way we work now is using lactate measurements to set zones. Not like super regularly, so it's in our practice, it's not really, I think it's not really possible to do that every 6 weeks. I don't see really an advantage of doing that, to be like, really, oh, we have 5 watts more, so we change now everything. Because we are working on a daily basis with the riders, so even with the power files we are receiving and seeing every day, we can also see improvement, especially with the additive feedback that riders are giving on their training sessions. But to set zones, we are using lactate measurements at specific intensities to see how more or less first aerobic threshold what it is, and then anaerobic threshold, and use that as FTP power, and then use those numbers together to set zones.
And is that testing actually less intensive on the rider because they're not doing a full gas 20 minute effort, so it is possible to do it more often during the season, theoretically?
Yeah. So we are doing a lab test in the winter to define VO2 max really measured, but that's also part of the medical testing. So it's for two purposes, and then on in the field we do maximal testing, 8 minute intervals. And sometimes we add a 5 minute all out, but 5 minute all out is still better to deal with for a rider than a 20 minute all out.
Yeah. And does this mean everybody needs to go out and purchase lactate measurement devices, or for...
No, we are helping them. So we are always there as coaches when doing those tests.
No, I mean for amateurs, like, is it really marginal and it doesn't make too much of a difference? And I guess FTP testing by power zone and then riding to power zones is still going to give you a lot of improvement, and that's how it was done at World Tour level anyway for a long time.
Yeah, but I believe if as an amateur cyclist you are really focusing a lot on 20 minutes and going a lot in those details, that's not the point in amateur cycling. The point is being consistent in your training, knowing yourself by doing specific training sessions and seeing how many watts you can do for 2 minutes or for 5 minutes. And also using your rate of perceived exertion, especially that, so your feeling about how intense a ride is. I think that's much more important than testing yourself every 6 weeks and going a lot into those details. Because I don't think as an amateur cyclist that's really the point.
Yeah, I mean, there's some, I know, like, I used to do it when I was at university, maybe because some people just take a lot of an interest in it, because you just, oh, I'm interested in you know, testing my physiological markers or whatever. But how does the preparation for a sprinter, a Dylan Groenewegen, who we just saw at the Dauphiné kind of doing for Jayco, almost training in that race with the hills, because it wasn't a great course for him before the Tour de France. How does a pure sprinter like that, their preparation for the Tour de France in terms of a training block and different sessions, differ from a pure GC rider? Is it as different as we think, or is the sprinter still doing a lot of threshold work, a lot of work with sprints added in? And is the GC rider also doing a lot of sprints as well, or VO2 work?
Well, I think the way we look at it is what's your key characteristic, your main speciality on how to win a race? And for a sprinter, obviously, that's that's sprinting as hard as you can. So have a 12 or a 15 second maximal power output as high as possible after a race, at the end of the race, obviously. Whereas for a GC rider, the longer efforts are more important to win the race. I think the biggest difference between a GC rider and a sprinter is the volume. So the training weeks are much more are much bigger for training for GC riders than for sprinters.
In terms of hours, not just intensity.
In terms of hours, yes, yes. Okay. And then also in terms of threshold training, I think a sprinter shouldn't do that a lot because it will limit his ability to sprint. On the other hand, he has to do some to get as fresh as possible to the finish of the race. So it's a tight balance. But if you terms and if you want to talk in general terms, I think the number of hours a GC rider is doing compared to a sprinter is much bigger. And then the number of the amount of threshold work a sprinter is doing should be less than a GC rider, which is pretty obvious.
Okay. And sort of taking that again to maybe something people can relate to, if someone is doing 60-minute flat criteriums, and first of all, can you even deplete all your glycogen in an event like that? Which means, like, does it really matter how efficient or what someone's fat max zone is if they're just racing flat criteriums for 60 minutes or less? And do they really need to be doing 20 hours a week or 25 hours a week? Or is really the determinant of success for that is, like, your repeatability of a 15-second power output? Do they really need to be doing a lot of threshold work at all? Especially if you've only got, realistically, 8 to 12 hours a week to train.
Yeah, that's an important point you're mentioning at last, because if you're pretty limited in hours of training, then you should try to maximize the effect of those training sessions as good as possible. Still, I believe even if it's a 60-minute effort, the aerobic part of that effort is very important, and being able to repeat a lot of 15-second surges or something is also defined by your aerobic capacity. And also the way how well do you recover from each sprint is more defined by your aerobic capacity than anything else. So still, I believe doing some volume for those 60-minute efforts, it's an important part of your training program. And obviously, when you're well fueled at the beginning, before the start of a race, and you have some 1 beat on the bike, you're definitely not going to be glycogen depleted after 60 minutes. But still, volume for a 60-minute effort is an important part of the training program, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I think I bonked on an hour and a half ride the other day at like hour and 15. I was completely empty. I was like, I didn't even think this was physically possible. I didn't bring any food with me. To go to the coffee shop, but apparently it is physically possible to deplete it after an hour 15. Just going back to something quite technical, and this is there was a rule change this year for the TT bikes. And for people that don't know, there was previously, I don't know it too well, it's sort of beyond me, it's very technical, but for riders over 190 centimeters, they were able to use certain extensions in recognition of the fact, or because of the fact, that they were so tall to allow them to get into a more aerodynamic position equivalent to, say, a 177 meter rider. Whereas riders like Pavel Sivakov, who's a good example, I think, he's about 187, 188 centimeters. He wasn't allowed to use, I'm just going to call them for simplicity, the special extensions. And you see Sivakov kind of cramped up under the previous rules. And I think there was the change this year, you'll know better than me, Mathieu, about was it scaling it so that now riders between 180 and 190 are allowed to use different extensions?
It's pretty straightforward. So the UCI now divided the all the riders in three length categories, category 1, 2, and 3.
Okay.
For category 1, basically nothing has changed compared to what it was before. Category 2 are the riders between 180 and 189 centimeters who are now allowed to put the handlebars 3 centimeters more forward, and they can then put their hands 2 centimeters higher. And then for the riders taller than 190, they can still put their handlebars at 85 centimeters in front of the bottom bracket, which hasn't changed since last year, but they can put their hands higher, 4 centimeters higher than previously. And then there are also some minor other changes, but these are the basic, the main changes compared to last year.
And how much of a difference does it actually make for Theo Gegenhardt, who's 182, or a Geraint Thomas, who's 182, or a 181, or a Mikael Björk, who's in that zone? Like, how many seconds are we talking over, let's pick a fictitious 30-minute flat, pancake flat, TT course, neutral wind?
I can't say, because aerodynamics is so special. There's no rule of thumb. I mean, when I go to the wind tunnel, I always say we go into the wind tunnel with 2 questions. We got 1 solution and 6 questions more at the end of the day. So it's very individual. But I think in terms of safety, there's already a little bit of improvement, because what in most of the riders, what they're trying to achieve is hiding their head behind their hands. So what we are doing that riders were only gripping their extensions with 2 fingers, whereas now, especially the taller riders being able to put their hands higher, they have more grip. So they can really grip the poles with more fingers and have more stability. I think that was also one of the things the UCI wanted, is to improve safety in a on the TT bikes. So that is a change, but I cannot say as a rule of thumb everybody is becoming faster because of the new rules. We tested some of the riders, unfortunately not all riders yet, were taller than 180, and for some riders it didn't really make a change, and for other riders it made a huge change in terms of aerodynamics. And that's why in the end you have to test everyone if you want to know how much the advantage is. So I cannot say as a rule of thumb the riders taller than 180 they become 30 seconds faster or something, because it's really individual.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I was speaking to a rider who tested it before the rule change, I think in middle of 2022 in that zone. And he was really excited before the wind tunnel test, because he'd got big power, and his TT was kind of, it was fine, but he's like, I got big power. Why can't I be, I should be an elite time trial rider. And then they tested the new position and he didn't really get faster. And he was actually pretty disappointed. He was like, maybe my body shape, my body conformation is just not aerodynamic, which is, like, also possible too. Like, people are built with different CDAs, I guess.
Yeah, but, it's true. But the way we look at it is, we take a system approach. So we really look not only at the bike or not at the rider, but just as a complete system. And you want to obviously make the complete system as aerodynamic as possible. But everything has an influence on everything. So making maybe your putting your hands higher will have also an influence on your shoulder and will also have an influence on your head position. So in the end, like I said before, there's no rule of thumb. You have to test everything out and try to go to the optimum. Everything, there's an interplay in everything in aerodynamics, and that's why the system is important and not just single helmet or the fastest wheel or whatever. We are looking at the system.
And how much does that change the system? Like, do you test like a slow speed system? Like, say you have the Tour de Suisse course where Schielmoser smashed the uphill part and then did a good descent, was, you know, not slow, but slower than a Usain Remco on the quick part. Do you test like a different systems for, okay, we have to do a climb on this course. We're going to go at 27 to 30 kph, maybe 25 kph on the climb, but we're not changing the TT bike. Do you test almost as well how to ride on those climbs, or what equipment changes for a slower course, or actually there's no equipment or gear changes for a 40 kilometer an hour average TT and a 55 kilometer an hour average TT?
Well, obviously when we're testing different wind speeds, so we have an idea of what is happening at lower speed and what's happening at higher speeds. But I think that the biggest change or the main thing that is changed is the position of the handlebar. So we can see in some riders that going lower is a little bit more faster, but it's something they cannot hold for, let's say, 40 minutes. So when we have a short prologue, we can put the rider in a more aggressive position. Because Sepp, we know he can make.
Sepp is a prologue master.
Yeah, he's the master. Yeah.
No, he did a good prologue in Tour de Romandie, I swear, like last year.
Yeah, and also in the Vuelta in Burgos, yeah, 2 years ago. Yeah, it's true. Yeah, no, but that's I think those are the things that can change a little bit. So more aggressive handlebar position when it's a short fast TT, whereas a little bit more comfortable when it's a little bit longer. So those are things that can change, influenced by the course or by the nature of the course.
Okay. And last question, I think it's on everybody's minds. It's because it just happened and it was one of the most strange TTs that we've ever seen. And I remember, you know, preparing for it, it was difficult to have answers of what would happen. The Giro, the final Giro TT, how much work went into that from your perspective? Given that there was really no frame of reference in recent cycling for a TT that was like that at all.
Yeah, a lot of work, obviously. And especially thinking, okay, what's the biggest, the best setup to go up that mountain? And the first 10K was pretty obvious. And yeah, I was happy that it was also very clear how the rules were. Well, in the end, it was very clear. There was not so much clarity up front, but we, as teams together, we made sure that there was this bike change zone and there was no way of changing the bike 2 kilometers afterwards, like Movistar in the Vuelta 2020. So that made it very, very clear what was asked and what had to be done. And obviously then you're going to analyze the course and the climb, how much power Primoz can push, we think, over that period of time, how much time will the climb take, what gear should be used, and also what gear Primoz likes to use. He's obviously a guy who likes to spin the legs a lot, so we needed a very, very small gear. But on the other hand, we wanted bigger chain rings for efficiency purposes. So all those things, yeah, were prepared up front, and Primoz was riding that bike already a lot in Tenerife. And never a chain drop, by the way.
Yeah, is it too soon to talk about the chain drop? What happened? He just hit a bump and...
He hit a bump and but because he was spinning so high, we think that the chain jumped a little bit, and before the chain was really completely back, he already pushed again and he just pulled it off. So yeah, not a nice thing to happen.
Right.
No, but yeah, looking at preparation, everything was taken into account, and especially also with Primoz's input, because also the helmet change is also something we considered, but Primoz was very, really, really clear on that
really?
That he just wanted to go full gas with the helmet, the TT helmet, we calculated also the loss of seconds when using a road helmet compared to a TT helmet, and also the TT helmet is obviously a little bit heavier than the road helmet, so
and heating.
So we also knew that he would lose a little bit time using the TT helmet up the climb. And in the end, you just put everything together and we talk with the rider, because in the end, you want to have a plan which is supported by the rider and not a plan that's just pushed by me or by the performance team. Because when it's not supported by a rider and the rider doesn't believe in it, it's never going to be as effective as in the situation where everybody's behind it. So, yeah. In the end, it worked out really well. But it's also because Primoz really, really determined on how to do it with the info we gave him.
Okay. And yeah, because I was thinking, if that was a 30-degree day, doing a climb at 12 kilometers an hour, wearing a TT helmet for 25 minutes, like, your head will cook, and there's got to be big losses. But I guess it wasn't. It was quite shaded on the climb and it wasn't so hot that day. And also, yeah, like, the psychological effect of, I don't think any rider likes changing bike during a TT. Like, no rider looks forward to, okay, I'm going to have to get off this bike, stand for 5 seconds, and then change bike. And some riders, maybe they don't mind it as much. When I looked at the Planche de Belfie bike change with Primoz, like, he looked, I don't think he wanted to change bike compared to, like, I don't know, Pogacar seemed more relaxed. Maybe that was because of knowing the time checks or whatever. But yeah, maybe the helmet thing is just an additional stress. Like, I'm going to have to take this off. But I guess, because I saw Van Wilder with the Snud, the specialized, I was like, that must be so hot on this climb. It might vary by helmet as well. Yeah, I guess you got another difficult TT to prepare for in the Tour, where that's also like a very, very difficult TT course to project. And I think it's becoming, it's always interesting to me to see the different strategies. And I think that Swiss TT was really, really interesting with how Schelmoser paced it. Knowing the rider's capabilities, like, he's really small. He's not that aerodynamic compared to Remco at 55 kph. And to save a little just basically smash the climb where the wind speed is lower, I think it's really interesting to see that across all teams, actually. And, understanding how all teams are understanding their own rider's capabilities. But, yeah, that's all I had. Thanks for letting me pick your brains. Matthew, good luck with the Tour de France. Do you go to the Tour for the start, or you just go for the on the second rest day before the TT?
Yeah, I'll be there a little bit earlier already to help the team out with bidons, etc. on the roadside in the Alpine stages, and then I'll be there for the TT, obviously.
Okay, well, good luck. Hope it all goes well. Thanks for coming on to LRCP.
Thank you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.